Before I begin, I should probably note that this is not going to be the sermon that was advertised, nor the sermon that Adam and I worked on during the week, but rather a sermon that appeared in my mind and my heart unbidden. And these things, if you're courageous enough, you have to listen to. So instead of to resist is to live and to live is to resist, we have resistance then and now. In 1963, the United States was in the midst of a cultural and moral crisis. In one of our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, our own Thomas Jefferson had written, as Adam read just a moment ago, "All experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed." Today, not only would we change the gender-specific language of the original, but we found another way of saying essentially the same thing. People will resist change until the thing that needs changing hurts more than the pain involved in making the change. People will resist changing until the thing that needs changing hurts worse than the pain involved in making the change. Because after all, each of us knows all too well from our own experiences, change is never easy. And rarely entirely pleasant. In 1963, the United States was in the midst of a cultural and moral crisis. African Americans had declared in numbers and vehemence as never before, as far as I know, that the system of racism being perpetrated was no longer sufferable. African Americans were saying that they were no longer disposed to suffer this evil any longer, and they demanded that its form be abolished. 1963 was the year that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said that the time had come for our country to make good on the promissory note it had written when it had declared that all men are created equal. It's interesting. We know that the version of the Declaration that was ratified by Congress is not the one Jefferson had originally written. The biggest difference is a rather long passage that condemns the British slave trade. But I found a very interesting change in the very first line, one which, if it had been adopted, would have made the link between the civil rights movement and the vision of our founders even more resonant. Instead of "the when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another," that we're familiar with, Jefferson had originally written, "when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for a people to advance from that subordination in which they have hitherto remained." Difference, and an important one. During the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, African Americans were declaring that it had become necessary to advance from that subordination in which they had hitherto remained. The evil of racism was no longer sufferable, and it was necessary that it be abolished. As I said, in 1963, the United States was in the midst of a cultural and moral crisis. In a very real sense, a new American Revolution was underway. And for our purposes this morning, it provides us an entree for looking at the idea and the experience of resistance. That's the theme we'll be exploring this month, the question of what it means to be a people of resistance. And the civil rights movement demonstrates at least two different kinds. First, perhaps most obviously, there were those who were rising up against, who were actively resisting the systems of racist aggression. Little slip, I meant to say racist segregation, but aggression is just as good. They were resisting both the institutions and the individuals that passively profited by it, as well as those that actively promoted it. The second kind, of course, were those who were resisting that resistance. Now, I keep coming back to 1963 because of two events that took place that year that I want to hold up. On September 15th, some people in Birmingham, Alabama, decided to make a show of just how strong their resistance to this racial revolution was. We've come to call this event the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, which destroyed a good part of their building, injured 22 people, and killed four little girls. Girls who are about the ages my boys are right now. As a response to this atrocity, which the Reverend Dr. King called one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity, the called minister here, the Reverend Walter Royal Jones, draped the outside of the church in black crepe. Roy Jones had been the head of the UUA Commission on Race and Religion, so the folks here should have known what they were getting when they called him. But maybe they thought that his having only been here for 3 months would have muted his more radical impulses. But when he took it upon himself to make this public statement of solidarity, the board quickly asked him to take it down. Although I imagine that few of us would ask him to do so today, we should not be too quick to judge them. No doubt there were some who were resisting his ministerial authority to take such an action on his own, and those who resisted putting the congregation into such an uncomfortable and perhaps even dangerous position, and those whose resistance grew from the notion that the civil rights movement was moving too fast and that change should come more slowly. And maybe even there were those who resisted the idea that change was necessary. One can be disposed to suffer evils for quite a long time when those evils are being committed against someone else. Jump to June of this year, when there was another act of violent resistance to the still overdue payment of our nation's promissory note. Much like the four men with the dynamite in Birmingham over 50 years ago, when Dylan Roof walked into the Emmanuel African American Methodist Episcopal Church, he was acting in resistance to the still ongoing efforts for the full recognition of African Americans as Americans. Hell, the full recognition of people of color as humans. His action was part of a long line of resistance against any effort by Black Americans and their allies to strive to advance from that subordination in which they had hitherto remained. Now, in response to this atrocity, I preached a sermon that several of you told me was the sermon you'd waited 4 years to hear. There'll be links to it on the website when this is posted. I also posted this Black Lives Matter sign. And while I don't want to have anyone infer that I think of myself in Roy Jones's league, I'd simply note that this act, too, has met with considerable resistance, and that I've also been asked to take down this very visible, very visual sign of commitment to the cause of racial justice. Now, before addressing this resistance, I want to tell you a brief story. Many years ago, when I was a member of our congregation in Waltham, Massachusetts, I was present on the Sunday when its lead minister, now a friend and mentor, delivered a sermon on the need for comprehensive gun control in response to the proposed opening of a gun shop just a few blocks away from the church building. As he stepped into the pulpit that day, he took off his robe, saying that he was too upset, too angry to step into that sacred space, that pulpit, as the Reverend Edwin Lane, MDiv, D-Min. Instead, he wanted to be clear that it was just Ed who was talking. It was a really powerful moment. I say this because I am not taking off my robe this morning, because I do not stand here as just Wick Wickstrom. 5 years ago, you called me to serve this congregation as its lead minister, to provide vision and direction, and to preach and teach the truth as I understand it. This is the truth as I understand it. We are today in the midst of a cultural and moral crisis, the like of which we have not seen since the time of the civil rights struggles in the 50s and 60s. The cancer that is racism has been eating away at our body politic since the first Africans dragged to this continent landed in Jamestown in 1619. 100 years or so earlier, if we remember the slave trade to Puerto Rico. And we, and I'm using that first person plural pronoun because I am a white American talking now primarily to other white Americans, we are seeing this with more heartbreaking clarity than many of us are used to. And it makes us uncomfortable. We don't want to believe that things can be as bad as we are now increasingly unable to deny that they are. We'd rather believe in a world of colorblindness that is post-racial. It hurts having to face the reality that this is still important, that it is still necessary to affirm that black lives matter. It's painful. It's deeply and profoundly disturbing. So we resist having to look at it. That's only natural. After all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. And as I said earlier, it is far easier to be so disposed when the evils are directly affecting someone else, and I remain relatively safe. Saying what I'm seeing, most of us white people in the U.S. today, are resisting acknowledging how truly evil the manifestations of racism are. And we resist the truth that until it is eradicated, until it is abolished completely and absolutely, we are ourselves suffering. Many of us, maybe even most of us, resist the assertion that the reality that we know in many ways is a fairy tale and is definitely and demonstrably not the reality of soon a majority of U.S. citizens. And so we so want to believe that if racism still exists, it is in the thoughts and the actions of a few mean-spirited people. And we resist acknowledging that the dangerous differences between white America and the America of people of color are systematic, built into the institutions and structures that support our entire society. Education, employment, housing, food distribution, marketing, entertainment, even religion. This resistance takes many forms, many of them completely unconscious to us. And this morning, still robed, I say that one of the ways we resist is to insist on our right to a safe space of solace away from the trials and troubles of this world. One of the ways we do this, one of the ways we support and perpetrate the ongoing systems of racial injustice and oppression is through our insistence that we are entitled to sanctuary. You and I, we can close our eyes for an hour or so. I can choose where and when to confront racism and its devastating effects. And because we can, we come to believe that it is our right to do so. So we resist seeing that this freedom not to see is part of our white privilege and our willingness to create sanctuaries in which to harbor ourselves in safe haven is part of the problem. Who says UUs don't shout out from the pews? So, our question for this month is, what does it mean to be a people of resistance? Being a people of resistance means that our Unitarian Universalist faith demands of us that we resist the temptation to take advantage of our privilege. And again, I am using that first-person plural pronoun intentionally. Being a people of resistance means that we must resist the inclination to see problems like racism that don't usually affect us tremendously personally as over there happening to those people. Even those of us who have black family members and black friends most often do not fully understand racism as our problem. But it must be our problem. Thinking otherwise simply perpetuates the status quo, even as we work to change it. I do understand that not everyone will agree with what I'm saying here this morning. I know that some of you will continue to find the presence of this garish black and yellow sign on humble poster board to be an unnecessary and unwelcome reminder of the cruelty and unfairness of the country, the world we live in, and an interruption of your desire to find peace. I know that it is and will always be disturbing and distressful to many of you. I know that there are some who will be angry as long as this sign stays up there, and I assume that there are those who will be angry enough to leave. I know these things, so I remind you this morning that neither my ordination to the ministry nor your call and installation of me to the office I now hold here makes the demand of me that I keep everyone happy or keep everyone here. Quite the contrary. Preach the truth in love is a command to say what I see in the world as kindly and caringly as I can, but not for a minute to falter from preaching that truth in order to keep the peace, or for my personal gain of your acceptance or appreciation. In fact, it's often been said that the deepest calling of the professional ministry is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. That is what I have been charged to do. Our charge as a people of resistance is to recognize just how often we put ourselves in the wrong category. This sign is an affliction to many here. I do understand that. Yet know, too, its presence here in this sacred sanctuary and safe haven of a congregation, of a community that could choose to close its eyes and its heart, is a great comfort, as well as a sign of hope to many whom racism afflicts each and every minute of each and every day, with no possibility of sanctuary or respite. A friend of mine said to me of this sign, "I just can't overemphasize the power of that sign in a UU sanctuary. It means safety, warmth, love, commitment to hard, uncomfortable work that must be done for all of us to be free. It makes this space for me a true sanctuary." That is the message for the morning.